It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
Alrighty, kids, welcome into a special edition of the Radio Hour. I am Matt Wardlaw, and my usual comrade Jeff Giles is not with me today. And I know how much he really wanted to be here for this one, because I've seen him listening to the music of the man we're going to be speaking with all day on Spotify. And while we will certainly miss Jeff on today's show, we are in very good hands. Joining me for this conversation is my better half, an occasional Pop Dose scribe, amongst many, many, many other things, Annie Zaleski. And she wanted to be a part of today's Radio Hour because we are both big fans of today's guest, and we share a mutual love and affection for the music of Grant Lee Phillips, no matter what name might be on the album cover. And for more than 20 years, Grant Lee has been sharing his songs with music fans worldwide, and it's certainly been an interesting journey, to say the least. We're looking forward to speaking with him about some of those highlights from the journey, which include his latest solo album, Walking in the Green Corn, and an additional release which came out recently that will be of particular interest to old school fans that have been following his career since the early days. It sounds really strange to talk about the 90s as being the early days, but I guess we're kind of getting to that point. We are here live in Cleveland today at one of our favorite venues, the Winchester, where Grant Lee's going to be performing tonight, and it's our thrill to welcome Mr. Grant Lee Phillips to the Radio Hour.
Thanks a lot.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you. My tea has arrived.
Thank you.
That's right. How are you guys doing?
We're doing real good, man. And, you know, we wanted to start off, since we mentioned Cleveland, we just wanted to start off and say Cleveland has always had a special connection with your music, and particularly they seem to really welcome in Grant Lee Buffalo at a time when there were so many bands and artists vying for attention and entertainment dollars. And, you know, just wanted to get some of your favorite memories of Cleveland.
Oh, goodness. I have a lot of them. You know, I mean, we came here back in the early 90s, played a lot of shows in the Flats. I remember that. And I've been sort of, you know, every time I come back, I seem to find some new nook or cranny, or both, here in Cleveland. It's much more green than I realized. I'm so accustomed to driving overnight and waking up on a bus in the Flats, and really having no sense of where I am and how to get to how to get to the club, and they just sort of roll me out in a road case.
I'm sure you've had quite a few of those experiences over the years.
I have, that's for sure. But it's nice. It's been a very nice, low-key kind of day driving through here.
Yeah.
You know, I came in from Ann Arbor.
I know we wanted to ask, what's got you out for this current run of dates? Because it's like five shows. It's just kind of a string of shows. What brought you out?
I'm doing more and more playing these days. You know, maybe 2 weeks ago, I was in Norway, Sweden, Denmark.
Wow.
Yeah, I was up in the Arctic Circle. And now I find myself in Cleveland, and I'm just doing more and more playing. I think it sort of comes with this whole changing of the industry. You know, if you hope to have folks hear your music, then it seems to be the way you have to go out and do it. You got to get out on the road and play it these days. And you know, I get a lot of pleasure out of playing these songs, and I've been very fortunate that people have. They've sort of stuck with me, and they've come back around even when the records were drastically different one from the next, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you used the word green, so we might as well move right into things. and I want to talk about your latest record, you know, Walking in the Green Corn. It's a release that has a really interesting underlying theme to it, with you exploring your roots and the formative elements of where you came from. How did this whole thing develop? Was it a total album concept from the get-go, or did this grow out of a particular set of songs and become that? How did it happen?
That's a good question. I almost don't remember now. Well, the truth is that I've always been inspired by the Native American side of my heritage, and really that's why Grant Lee Buffalo is called Grant Lee Buffalo, you know, because of that. And now and then there would be a song or two that would pop up. The Last Days of Tecumseh. Susanna Little, which is the story of my great-grandmother. Were You There, which is the story of Wounded Knee. So those songs have emerged. But with this record, I really wanted to spend a little more time there. And not each of them is right on the nose, but so many of them are inspired by the mythology, the history, all of that goes along with our indigenous culture here.
Yeah. Well, I think we should start by having you play a song from the record, and I guess maybe Buffalo Hearts, and maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about that one from your perspective.
Well, Buffalo Hearts is really it's all about ancestral connections, making that connection to the generations before you and passing that knowledge on to the next one and the next one. Continuity, I guess, is what that song's all about. You know, I have folks in my family that go way, way back where we can trace it all to the Trail of Tears. And I think about that, the sacrifice that you know, each of us has our, you know, our former generations to thank for that, the fact that we're here. Remember the ones who traveled so far, all that was lost on that walk, Buffalo Hearts. Under the grass, under the stars, honor the past and show Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts. They lifted you up and out of the dark. A blanket of love kept you warm, Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts. Remember the young children of ours, so they become great and strong, Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts, Buffalo Hearts.
When did you really start to become aware of that?
Oh, I grew up knowing that, actually. I grew up knowing that, but it's been an ongoing pursuit in terms of, you know, spending those hours online and reading books and, you know, just doing. I love researching everything. And for me, that always is a big part of songwriting, you know. I mean, you get the initial surge of ideas, but it's always nice to have some new fodder, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And speaking of fodder, I became a fodder. I have a daughter who's 5 years old. And that really had a lot to do with wanting to understand the history of my own family and all that, you know? Yeah.
So how has fatherhood changed, I guess, the way you approach songwriting? Has it at all?
There's less time to do it. But there's a more joyful life to draw from, a much richer one for sure. And it becomes harder and harder to go out on the road and be away from home as well. And yet, you know, I must bring home the bacon, even though we don't eat a lot of bacon. But, you know, I still like a little bacon now and then.
How aware is she then that you're a musician? And is she aware of your music at all? Do you play that for her?
I try to. Sometimes she'll say, turn it off, you know. But generally speaking, she likes it, and I think she likes it anyhow. I'm going to say she likes it. She wants to join my band, you know.
Aww.
Yeah.
She's five. It's only going to get worse, too. Oh, Dad, you're embarrassing me. He's not playing those songs.
That's probably true. That is probably true. But I'd like to think I'm bringing her up on some good music, you know. Not my own necessarily, but... You know, I try to turn her on to things like, you know, well, I don't know. I think it was a Cramp song that she was one of the first songs that I sang with her.
That's a pretty high bar.
Yeah.
You know, it's all downhill from there. Start off
that's
that
right.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. You start with the top shelf.
Making this record then, what was the biggest difference then this time around than making any other records? Was there any, the process of, was there anything, you know, very specifically different or?
Well, this one sort of snuck up on me and that's probably, it's always a healthy thing. I was writing songs and almost as quickly as I could write, I would go and put the idea down, assuming that at some point I would bring in a band and I would re-record these songs in a real studio as opposed to my home studio, which is real enough, but it just seemed like it was almost too comfortable. You know, I could sit there and play a song and when I felt like it. And then as I played it all back for my wife, you know, she gave me a lot of objectivity. And, you know, she was the one who said, no, that's great. You got it. You know, don't redo that. That you had it right the first time. And that's sort of how the album emerged, really, you know. Even some of Grantley Buffalo's records were like that, though. You know, we thought we were recording demos and a fuzzy, and that wound up becoming... We tried to outdo ourselves. We tried to re-record it in the big studio, and we never could quite get whatever was there on the demo. You know, that happened with quite a few of our songs.
I remember that on Mighty Joe Moon, too, there were a couple songs.
Yeah, there were songs that were demos, actually, and even during the recording of Mighty Joe Moon, we were touring so much that I felt like, well, I think I've almost got a song. I think so. You know, Honey, Don't Think. That's why it only has like 2.5 verses or something like that. Probably if I would have waited, it would have been a longer song. But there wasn't that kind of, you know, that kind of time. It was a very urgent period.
It's a fairly concise collection of songs, which is something my comrade Jeff would thank you for, keeping it at a reasonable length as far as running time.
Yeah.
Did you record more songs than what made the record?
There were a couple that I was on the fence about. I just felt like, nah, I got to keep chasing this. Maybe two or three other songs that, and maybe they'll turn up somewhere else, you know. I'm not sure why that is. That I don't know. Sometimes songs have a twin, and, you know, and for that reason, you don't want to put them on the same album. You feel like you've already covered that ground, you know. But there's a few that got left off. I like a short record these days, so anyhow. You know, 5 songs per side. It's perfect for vinyl.
Do you struggle with that, finding that new ground that doesn't feel like somewhere you've already been?
Not necessarily. In fact, when I do find myself writing some kind of song that feels familiar, I just, you know, I take it as though, wow, this is, yeah, that makes sense. You know, it resembles the rest of its brothers and sisters, and it's just it's a natural thing. I don't really fight that. In fact, it's usually a sign that I'm not overthinking it and that I'm on some kind of organic track, you know. I don't know. Now and then I'll surprise myself and write something that's totally out of character. And that song is often buried in, you know, in a safe and thrown into the sea with concrete, you know. Yeah.
So you have a polka record in the vaults then?
A polka record in the vaults.
Yes.
I just might, actually. Yeah.
I remember R.E.M. when in the 90s they would always say, you know, we'd write a song that sounds like R.E.M. and then we'd totally ditch it because we can't, you know, we don't want to repeat ourselves and do that. And
boy.
There are like 2 schools of thought.
Well, if the rest of us can write a song like R.E.M., it's not going to be ditched.
Well, I like that you recorded the record at home and then you went the crowdfunding route with Pledge Music to bring this home. And how did you go in that direction then? What led you there?
Well, goodness, I've been on major labels, I've been on indie labels, and there are, you know, there are pluses to all of those things. I mean, I've certainly been fortunate in that I've been able to reach a lot of people with my earlier albums that were more widely promoted than I can ever do on my own these days. That helps a great deal. But I just felt like it was such a personal record, and I had already recorded it on my own. It's just becoming more and more the manner of doing things, you know. However, you can do it on your own. It seems to be the way to go, you know. There are less record stores, sadly, these days, you know. I mean, I say that record stores. There are actually more records, literal record stores, than there have been in a while. But you know, you have to download music these days, and you have to kind of dig for it even more so. So this just seemed like the kind of album that was worth just approaching it in a totally different way. You know, the previous record, Little Moon, was put out through Yep Rock, and I'm really proud of that record. But I felt like, well, this one I can go about it. I can go about it differently. And it's been satisfying, though. It was really meaningful. I think a lot of musicians have a hard time gauging or having a real tangible sense of how much people are really paying attention or listening to their music, you know. You don't get that from, you know, the accountant's office. And if you do, it's probably 2 years behind if you ever do, you know, the way it's all set up. You get that at shows. You get that immediate sort of connection. And that's why playing out, you know, means so much. It's such a direct connection. But the Pledge Music route was very much along those lines, you know. People were plugged in from the beginning.
Well, I like Pledge Music too, because it does feel like you have a one-to-one connection. Like it's like your own little page.
Yeah.
It's like a direct line. And you can see, and it's also kind of, I think, addicting probably to look and say, all right, I'm almost pledged. I'm almost there. You know, I got 50%. All right, 55%.
Like, yeah, right.
You know, but I've pledged many things on Pledge Music, and I like their model, and I like what they do. Like, it's very,
yeah.
You know, you feel like you're making a difference. You feel like there's a tangible thing, even though it's digitally.
Right. That's right. Yeah, often it seems very unreal and hard to get your head around, hard to get your arms around it, this whole industry, you know. it just doesn't make much sense, you know. Playing music makes sense. You feel that. You feel that in your bones. But, I don't know, reading sheets that tell you how much you're in the hole, you know, just there's no kind of there's no kind of gratification there.
Well, you know, I spoke with an artist a few years ago in the early days of crowdfunding, and they admitted some discomfort with the process and said that however you want to term it, it ultimately is begging, which is something that doesn't feel very comfortable. And it seems like crowdfunding has really taken hold since then. And it seems like a little bit that the awkwardness of that might have slipped away a bit. How was that part of things for you?
Well, I suppose it all depends on how you go about it. And really what this is it's a means of pre-ordering the album.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you are providing something, you know. You're providing a physical record, you know. I sold CDs, LPs. These things were pressed up after we raised the funds. The album was already recorded. But, you know, I mean, those years and all of that time and money invested in building up a studio and all of that kind of stuff, you know, the tools that it takes to make an album, even an inexpensive one, it takes a lot of energy, you know, and resources. I also sold artwork, guitars, you know, I mean, it was a...
Your first guitar, if I saw that, the first Yamaha acoustic?
Yeah, that's right. It was a 12-string, was the first 12-string.
But what's it like letting go of something like that for your art?
It was, you know, I met the fellow who bought it. It's like kind of getting rid of your kittens or something, I guess,
right.
You know, he seemed like a nice guy, you know, so I'm happy it's in good hands that somebody will, you know, will treat it with love, you know, cause it probably wasn't going to be played again. It was going to remain in that case and, you know, and cared for, but it wasn't left out in the rain or anything like that. But, yeah, I have a lot of good memories associated with that instrument. It always happens. I mean, I heard somewhere years ago, like, oh, instruments are a great investment, you know, the resale. And I can't get rid of an instrument, you know. It's like,
yeah.
It's like, you know, like pawning your grandmother or something like that, you know.
Depending on the grandmother, though, pawning might be an option. You know, I know the guys at Pledge a little bit, and I want to, you know, move on. But I will say that as far as the whole process of crowdfunding goes, I've always liked it on a couple different levels. You know, one is the artist, as you kind of alluded to, it guarantees that a certain number of people are going to buy your record.
Mm-hmm.
And two, you know, I think for us as music fans, for the artists that do it right, and you certainly did it with this record, it really brings an experience that many of us would have killed for, you know, growing up with the bands we were listening to, that fly on the wall view of the album making process shared through updates, photos, mm-hmm. and videos, and sometimes even demos of the tracks as the album's starting to come together. And I guess my perspective is that for an album that I was going to buy anyway, I mean, I'm always happy to put my dollars towards, you know, something like that, that for the same price I was going to pay for the record anyway.
Right, right.
I get so much more. And I mean, you know, this project, you know, for this record, like there just were so many updates and things associated. I mean,
yeah.
you poured yourself into it. It's not like you just threw it up and said, hey, we're going to, you know, raise some money,
right.
but I'm not really going to put a lot
right.
into the process. You really did.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm really moved by the faith that all of these folks showed, and you know my abilities and because, you know, they weren't able to hear the record, you know. You weren't able to play a few seconds like you would on iTunes, you know. And in fact, you would order it, and then you might be waiting a few months before the thing was actually pressed up, you know. And then, boy, lucky me, the vinyl was pressed up, and then the Beatles decided to re-release their entire catalog on vinyl. So it meant that all of these little vinyl pressing plants were completely involved in that process of getting Beatles records together. And so, you know, records like my own, where it's only, you know, a few units, were all kind of put on the back burner.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a tough one to try to explain to everyone. It's really come, I swear, it's on the way. The problem is this band called The Beatles, you know.
Yeah.
It's always The Beatles.
Yeah. Why don't we have you play another song from the new record? And this one being the Straight and Outer. And I guess tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, this song is based on the idea of a sacred clown. And it's an indigenous story where the Straight and Outer goes about literally trying to hammer out everything in nature that is organic. You know, the winding river, the bowl, the gourd, all of it, trying to hammer it out to the needs and the specifications of mankind, the crazy sort of monkey side of our brain that wants to take control of everything, you know, control the weather. And I found that a really fascinating idea, that it's such an ancient idea. You know, the clown really, the clown reflects all of that madness in each of us. And so it's quite profound, really, you know. So I latched onto that idea, and that, and thus the song, The Straight and Outer.
Thunder on the mountain birds, lightning in the sky, hammer on the straight and outer, working overtime. In all the world's a rattlesnake waiting to unwind. In his crooked mind, the birds of prey, they circle over black-winged birds. Smithy the straight and outer, hammer out the curve. Folly of the straight and outer, make the ravens laugh. Nature, she get all the power he will never have. He will never have. He will never. Thunder of the straight and outer, sparking up the sky, the hammer of the straight and outer, working overtime. And all the world's a rattlesnake waiting to unwind, and all the world needs setting straight in his crooked mind. The story of the straight and outer, the story of the straight and outer, the folly of the straight and outer.
I love the video of Thunderbird that you and your wife made during the process of the Pledge campaign. How'd you guys shoot that one? I always think it's, we've been talking to a few artists recently that have been taking advantage of the technology. So I'm always kind of interested to hear how something like that comes together.
So. Well, we wanted to create something special for the fans who were involved with the Pledge Music campaign. And my wife she's shot all of the photographs for my album covers, and we've made some other videos together. And it was basically a document of me playing that song live in our den. And it was really just as simple as that, just another way of sharing something in the most direct way that we could.
Grantley Buffalo is a very visual band. Like, I think I found out about you guys because the Lone Star Song video on 120 Minutes.
And oh, right.
It's just a very vibrant video type thing. And so talk a little about how different than our things. You're talking about, making a video in your living room as compared to 20 years ago when there were these, budget videos on MTV. Like, it's...
Well, you know what? I mean, when I first started watching MTV, I was just taken by it, like most of us. Wow, here is this medium that is combining everything I love, all of the interesting imagery. I've always drew and I've been into artwork, and so I just found this new medium to be incredible. But when Grantley Buffalo came along and we were able to make those videos, we were lucky to meet up with a guy named Carlos Grasso who did... He did just about all of our videos, except for like one or two. He did Lone Star Song and Fuzzy, some others, a longer short film called El Dorado Motorhome. But Carlos, he is such an all-around artist, just kind of wakes up and that's what he does. And I think he shot all that stuff on his own, did all the editing, he's kind of a one-man band in that way. And he's a writer and has a band of his own called Dumb Fucks that you must check out. They're out of New Orleans. James Slate and Carlos Grasso. But that's D-U-M-F-U-X-X. So it's not a dirty word. Not a dirty word at all.
Technically.
Yeah. We were lucky that we were able to... I say collaborate, but guys like Carlos, really, they were the ones who helped create that. But I think there was kind of an aesthetic, though, anything slightly torn and frayed and rusted and dusted was right for Grantley Buffalo.
Talking about Grantley Buffalo, you guys were kind of the last gasp of bands that came up through the traditional major label system when it was everything. Talk a little bit about that journey from, I guess, becoming a band to getting signed and maybe the reality check that came at some point in comparison to what you might have been expecting.
Well, you know what? I mean, my goal to begin with was just make records, In the 80s, I was involved with a band called Shiva Burlesque, and that's actually where I met Joey Peters and Paul Kimball, who were part of that group as well. Jeffrey Clark and I started the band, and that was sort of my schooling in terms of making independent records and putting them out. And I don't know, we didn't even have a word like indie yet. It was underground or however you could do it,
Yeah, we were going to ask really what the shift was that made you move from that to like starting your own thing, or starting a different thing.
Well, I mean, I had spent about 7 years from the time I was about 19 years old until I was my mid-20s being a guitar player and co-songwriter in Shiva. But at that point, I had so many songs and I was just kind of feeling that urge. I needed to step forward and start doing my own thing. And I did so, and probably within about 3 years or something like that, we signed with Slash, which were, they were a great little label, small label. But they did have this relationship with Warner Brothers and with Polygram overseas. So it wasn't long before our band was starting to reach a pretty good size audience in terms of the distribution. It was always changing, Warner Brothers, it was like a revolving door, the presidents at that company. I think there was like three presidents in the time that we were there, that period. And nobody was ever on solid footing, that entire period. And I think it's probably only gotten more like that, So I guess as a musician, you sort of have this instinct built into you that just do whatever I got to do to keep on playing, It's that's what it comes down to, you know, if it means doing it on your own or with an indie or however, you know, just keep on playing.
I talked to Steve Berlin from Los Lobos last year, and he,
oh yeah, they were a Slash band.
Yeah, I was gonna say, he told some interesting stories about, you know, being at Slash and just the vibe there, and, you know, really kind of almost working in the mailroom, and, you know, seeing like some of the demos that were coming in, like, you know, a demo for a future band that would go somewhere called Faith No More, and just
right,
all the interesting things that were happening there. So, I mean, it...
Yeah,
it,
that was slightly before we signed
yeah.
on as well. Yeah, of course, X and...
Yeah.
Boy.
It just seemed like an environment that really fostered some interesting bands, you know, like your band, and,
yeah.
you know, gave support to a band like Los Lobos, and they signed... I think they were one of those record labels that, as a music fan, you knew that if you were getting something on Slash, it was probably interesting.
I think
worth hearing.
Yeah, I think that's really true. That's totally true, and that's a credit to those guys who, you know, who started that label, and our A&R guy, Randy Kay. He's no longer alive, but I mean he stuck his neck out and signed us, and you know, we're always grateful for that.
Well, you mentioned Shiva Burlesque. Any plans to maybe reissue some of that music? I mean,
that stuff was reissued actually, like, maybe, I don't know, 9 years ago, something like that. I don't know that if it's any more available
yeah.
now than it was back in the day. I mean, I think it came out like in, I want to say, 88 or something like that.
Well, the alternative music era, I mean, it was an interesting time for music. And I look at that, you know, it seems like it was widely defined on the radio dial to the point that, you know, bands with kind of quirky names like Grantley Buffalo, Toad the Wet Sprocket, and Big Head Todd and the Monsters, I mean, bands like that could get radio play, and they had a place where they fit in. I don't know if that would happen now.
I don't know what happens on radio these days. I really don't. I mean, I think it's mainly people screaming at each other, you know, and that's... and now and then, you know, there's some sort of, I don't know, there's a good recipe or two on your NPR, that kind of thing, you know. I don't know, man. I brought some CDs with me. I bought the Time Life Country Collection, so and Exile on Main Street, and a few others. But yeah, I don't know. I think ever since things kind of became a lot more corporatized in the 90s, you know, radio began to suffer, you know, and you know, the playlist always they started to resemble you know, one another, you know. It was just a case of, I don't know, taking all the chance out of it, you know. That's the best thing about this whole business, is that nuts like ourselves can occasionally slip through the door, you know, and the next nut in line. But you can't control it too much. If you do, then, you know, you lose out on who knows what, you know.
Where do you find that people like find out about your music now? I know you have a lot of, they're on TV shows and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I people find out about my stuff in all sorts of ways, you know. I guess one of the things that happens is when you order one record, it might tell you to, you might like this, that kind of thing. Some sort of algorithm that makes your musical choices for you, which is kind of weird, but you know, I don't know how that happens, but I'm happy when it works to my favor. I was on Gilmore Girls for 7 seasons, so I meet a lot of folks who found out about my stuff through that, you know, or maybe they heard a song, you know. Friends with Benefits, the movie, the Justin Timberlake, you know, I covered a song, and you know, Boys Don't Cry, the Cure song. So in any number of ways people find out about me. I bump into them, you know, with my shopping cart, and what the hell, and then I give them my demo, you know. So
we were actually going to ask you about Gilmore Girls, because Matt was talking to a coworker this week, and she said that she had no idea Sebastian Bach was in a band. She only knew him from Gilmore Girls. I was wondering if you ever have that experience, if people like, yeah, I was in a band, it was solo career. No,
that's how I know
guy.
Sebastian Bach, actually. Nice. Yeah, I do remember him being on a Rolling Stones cover, but yeah, he's a nut jobber. He's very funny. I like him.
That.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I was born in that era where musicians and actors and jugglers, they were, you know, they were one and the same, and you just, you know, show people, and it just makes sense to, you hope that some, you expect it, you assume it's going to be required of you in your skill set to do a little song and dance, you know, play a song, be in a show, you know. Maybe that's happening anyway, you know, for that younger generation, you know, the Justin Timberlakes and the Selena Gomez's of this world.
It does seem like that they, you know, they don't see any barriers. They're like, oh, I can sing. Oh, I can act too. Why not?
Right, right. Where that was sort of like, I can't imagine the best of our, you know, the best songwriters that I have known in my life stepping into that role necessarily. You know, they've got all of their powers in the field of songwriting. You know, they were too cool for that. You know, I don't know. Can you imagine it? I'm not sure.
You know, it depends on the songwriter. Like, you know, I mean, like there was that Nickelodeon show, The Adventures of Pete and Pete.
Right.
And they had so many. Like, I think Michael Stipe was on there. Kate Pearson.
Well, that's true. That's true.
But it's like they were all playing quirky characters.
Right.
You know, there wasn't anything, you know, playing a straight character. Like, I think someone like Justin Timberlake, I mean, he does his pop thing. But then,
right.
You know, he's acted in a wide variety of things.
Yeah, he's quite funny.
He's so funny.
I prefer him as a funny man. Actually,
as dressed
you
up
know,
as tofu like on SNL.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
he's great.
Well, what's your background then? Do you have any background in either
my
comedy
background?
Or acting or anything like that before?
Oh well, you know what I mean. When I was a kid, I was like a 10-year-old magician. I did magic when I was a boy, and my mom would take me around from place to place. You know, an amusement park. Like a men's club, and I would do my act, and I had doves, and I had some fire. It was kind of dangerous, really. And from there, I found myself at a vaudeville revival house, and I started doing that every weekend. And then I was a self-taught stuntman in a ghost town, in a Western ghost town. So I have this sort of interesting kind of background before. I ever started playing the guitar, you know. Once I found the guitar, then I kind of figured, well, maybe I'll leave the doves behind and I'm going to stop jumping off of wagons.
And leave the fire behind.
Yeah, exactly.
Who really inspired you to pick up a guitar then? What bands or musicians or songwriters?
Oh, goodness. All sorts of people. I mean, the Beatles, you know, Help, the movie Help, Glenn Campbell, Johnny Cash. You know, all of those artists that were really big in the mid '60s and into the '70s. You know, especially people like Johnny Cash, Roy Clark, even. You know, a lot of the country people. It was a big time for all of those folks, and you know, the list goes on and on and on. You know, yeah, I'm a real sponge. You know.
That's cool, though. I mean, it's interesting seeing, you know, everything in your background kind of seeping into your music. You know, it's
yeah.
just the melting pot, which is cool, though.
Yeah, yeah. It all gets, I sweat it out in some way or another.
Well, I want to move just into a few more things, and then we'll head towards wrapping here. But, you know, somebody that I saw you mention pretty recently, we had somebody on a radio hour recently. We had Bill Payne of Little Feet. And one of the key experiences for him making the latest Little Feet record was getting to use Richard Manuel's piano,
which is
housed at the studio where they were recording that on that record. And it was a deeply moving experience for him. And he's already talking about songs that he wants to record using that same piano on the next record. And I know Richard was a big influence for you personally. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, him and that?
Well, I mean, I love the band,
yeah.
You know, you know, those, you know, The Weight, so all of those great songs like that, you know, they definitely had an influence on my songwriting in terms of the early Grantley Buffalo stuff,
yeah.
For sure, you know, that whole rustic sort of tone, you know, the fact that there's such history and such story embedded in all of those songs.
What did you get out of that? As some of that, as far as like song structure, like as you started to like, did you start to look at some of those songwriters and go and see kind of certain things they were doing that contributed like important things to how you would write songs?
You know, it wasn't a conscious thing, but it just really resonated with me.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, going back to what we were covering earlier, being interested in history and in Native American history, for instance,
yeah.
You know, my given name, you know, Grant Lee, I've always been fascinated with the Civil War and that whole time in American history and it was pretty apparent that, you know, you'll find all of that, you know, and more in the music of the band. But I must plead ignorance. I only in time did I become really aware of just the huge presence that Richard Manuel had in the band, you know, because I've always been drawn to the songs that Levon Helm sang. You know, I mean, I think he's just like the most incredible singer there ever was. Yeah. And maybe part of that was that he's also one of the most incredible drummers and he's doing it all at once. And so you feel that in his voice, you know, that rhythm and that, that whole sway, you know. But man, Manuel is just incredible. I've been covering Whispering Pines a little bit lately, and I love his songs. And that piano, as I understand, is somehow kind of got out of tune.
Yeah.
And that led to these interesting chords, and which you'll hear on Whispering Pines and a bunch of his songs, you know. I just love those things.
I think that's something we always look at, is like how some of the best things obviously come out of the mistakes and what people will call like the wrong notes and just all the things you're not supposed to do.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you know, contribute some of, you know, just some things that become classic.
Right. Tears of Rage. There's another one.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I mean, there's just, man, talk about anguish in a vocal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that stuff. So, yeah, I'd love to get my hands on that piano as well.
Well, I know, and maybe you'll have your chance. It's apparently out there and available for use, you know, if you know the right people at the right recording studio. Yeah, yeah.
It's Bill, here in Cleveland?
No, it's not in Cleveland. I'm trying to think where it's based, but wherever Little Feat recorded their latest record, like, it's at that studio, and that was apparently, like, a huge contributing factor that, like, when he found out that that piano was there, he's like, oh, we're doing the record there. So he wrote... Bill Payne wrote a whole long thing about the experience on his website. It's just great reading.
I think of that movie, The Shining, you know, where Scatman says, you know, there are certain places that shine. and it's true of instruments, you know. There are instruments that shine.
Yeah.
And you know that a song is going to fall out of the hole of that guitar, that, you know, that songs live in that guitar and in that piano.
Well, fans are really, really stoked, I think, about the appearance of a Grant Lee Buffalo live record.
Yeah. Although I don't know that they'll experience the appearance of it, because it's entirely virtual. It's a download. But you'll find it. You'll find it online at CD Baby and iTunes and other places for sure. Yeah, it was a really great special moment that was captured, and it was one of the first shows that we performed together after a long 15-year hiatus, and it was in London to a crowd of thousands and thousands and thousands, and it was a good one.
We were talking about, first of all, I'll say about that live record, is that I think that's kind of one of the cool things about where the industry is at this point, is the fact that you can take a, you know, 80-minute-plus Grant Lee Buffalo show and put it out there.
Yeah.
You know. Here it is. I know there was some work that went into, you know, mixing and all that kind of stuff, but you don't have to condense it down to 13 or 14 tracks that are going to fit on a single disc. You can just say, here it is.
And right. Put
it
That's out, true.
You know?
Yeah.
It'd be really nice if I knew where I was going with that whole thing.
No, you're right. That is one of the great things about that.
So I know where I was going with that. We were actually talking on the way over here just about, you know, the fact that you did those shows over the UK in London, and you know, also, for example, I know you played a show in Dublin as well, and I think that for a lot of bands maybe getting back together and playing their first shows after a long time being away, there could be some trepidation about, you know, going over, you know, first of all, like in your, you know, I guess almost homeland of the U.S., are people still going to care? But certainly now we're going to go overseas and chance whether people are still going to care or not. So
right.
I guess we were just wondering, like, did you always have like a pretty big UK following for the band?
Yeah, I think it was bigger overseas than it was here.
Yeah.
And if anything, you know, the urging of our fan base to, you know, when are these guys going to get it together and play a show together again, you know, that kind of pushed us. So it wasn't such a scary thing when we finally decided to do that. That said, we, you know, we have a couple of shows lined up for the summer, but it's just kind of like, it's, you know, here and there when we feel like, you know, the time is right, and it's not a full-blown kind of full-time thing.
Yeah, it's here and there. I mean, do you see the possibility of like more of a like full-scale thing at some point where you would go out and do a longer tour? Is that something that's of interest?
We're talking about doing some more things, you know, down the road. Just kind of filling it out, you know. Mighty Joe Moon will, it's been almost 20 years since it came out. So, you know, maybe we should celebrate that.
You know, that's funny you bring that up, because we were noting that the 20-year mark is coming up on that one, and just wondering if there might be any sort of reissue plans or anything.
At the moment, no. There's nothing like that, but I'm sure we'll think of it in 30 years from now.
Could you see the band making another record? Is that something you have interest in?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not certain. It's such a hard thing to put myself into that mindset, you know. I can't remember what was going through my mind when we made the first three or four albums. It was kind of crazy. So I don't know. I'm not certain. I don't know. I don't know that it would resemble the same band that it was at that time.
And you've gone a long distance. I mean, you've made, you know, 7 records on your own since the last Grantley Buffalo record. So, I mean, certainly you've traveled a lot of miles and gone a lot of interesting places with the songs that you've just been, you know, doing since then.
Yeah, so. I don't know. It's hard. It's I don't see that in the cards necessarily. Yeah. And I just have such a good time playing the old songs, really.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I guess a lot of bands feel compelled to create new product, and there is certainly a lot of urging, you know, that we get, you know, like, if you guys want to book a big tour, then where's the new record, you know? But it seems like that's sort of like, you know, really, I wouldn't want to make a record just for the sake of supporting a tour and going out on that tour for the sake of, I don't know, it just seems like that's so arbitrary. Yeah. You know, the songs kind of have to just sprout up, and the band has to just sort of rise to the occasion, I guess. It has to be much more organic than that, but maybe that's not how things happen. I don't know. Maybe they need a little bit of a little force behind them. I'm more organic than that, though.
I really respect bands who, if they do get to do some shows, they don't make a record. Because it's like, you're right, you don't want it to be forced. And you can tell when bands are like, oh, I guess we got to make a record. It feels organic.
I mean, it's those albums, the best songs in our catalog, they really just took us by surprise. And I don't know. I don't know that I could repeat that. I wouldn't want to try to copy that, you know. I feel like we have a lot to live up to in terms of our own honoring everything that we did together in the 90s, and it would have to feel as good as it did then.
Sorry, Beth. Is that messing things up?
No.
Okay, never mind.
We have a little background music now.
We do.
We've added a little bit of production to the show.
little bed of music.
Little music bed.
On the radio, yeah. Exactly. That's right. All right. I was actually wanted to ask you about, you've co-written songs with a bunch of different people, and including Margaret Cho. And I was very interested in that collaboration. I like, and we watched the video for Asian Adjacent that you're in this afternoon. And I was like, I would never have thought that. Do you know her from L.A. or is it?
I do. Yeah. One of the perks of playing this place called Largo, which is, you know, where I used to play a whole bunch. And I do occasionally play there these days, but it's moved from the small cabaret that it was to a bigger theater, really nice theater in L.A. And but I've met loads and loads of musicians and comedians, and Margaret was one of them. Goodness, you know, maybe like in the mid-90s we met, and I invited her and some other folks to a Halloween party, and that was the beginning of a long friendship. Wow. And a few years back, she wanted to make a record of music, and she had all of these insane lyrics, and they were great, and I contributed my part, some music and some production, and lo and behold, you know, did a couple of songs together. She's great.
Largo is one of those scenes that, like, if you're not in L.A., it has, like, this mythic quality to it, because you look at all the musicians who have played there and collaborated there, and it's just, like, if you're a fan of songwriters, you're just like, oh, my God, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
Some of the nights. It just seems like a very creative place, kind of very organic. Like you might.
It was very organic, you know, and it was just a given that any, you know, any particular night could involve, you know, rubbing elbows with Elliot Smith and John Bryan and Zach Galifianakis and Jack Black, and, you know, I mean, not to drop names, but these were some of the regulars who I got to see, you know, with you know, like a fly on the wall, you know. It was just wonderful, really wonderful. I mean, you know, such creative people that came through there.
Do you want to have them play us out with a song?
Yeah. I will then. So you're going to play Happiness by Grantley Buffalo. So
yeah.
What about that song still resonates with you?
Oh, I think what I love about it is that it just gives me such pleasure to spread such gloom, such despair, you know, in abundance. You know, it's a blues song without, you know, without the hips, without the swagger. Yeah, Happiness.
What do you have on tap for the rest of the year then? You're doing some dates, and so then what's the rest of your year look like?
The rest of my year involves more touring. I'm going to be in the Pacific Northwest, playing in Portland and Seattle in June. I have a great show coming up at McCabe's in L.A.
Oh,
later
nice.
On. Yeah, a few things like that. I'm finally playing the Calgary Folk Festival as well.
Oh, cool.
Later on this summer. And Grantley Buffalo will be joining Toad the Wet Sprocket and doing a couple of shows on the West Coast. So, yeah, we've got a nice full plate.
West Coast travel plans. All right.
Yeah.
Well, hey, thank you so much for doing this. This was so much fun, man.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Never mind me, cause I've been dead. Out of my body, been out of my head. Never mind the songs they hum. Don't wanna sing along, nothing that I said. Could it bring you happiness, happiness, hard to come by? I confess that I'm bad at this, happiness, if you find it, share it with the rest of us. Never mind the words that came out of my mouth when all that I could feel was pain. The difference in the two of us comes down to the way you rise over things that I just put down. Let it bring you happiness, happiness, hard to come by. I confess that I'm bad at this, happiness, if you find it, share it with the rest of us, with the rest of us. Never mind me, cause I've been dead. Out of my body, been out of my head. Never mind the curse of war, proud like a badge that just don't shine no more. Let it bring you happiness, happiness, hard to come by. I confess that I'm bad at this, happiness, if you find. Share it with the rest of us, 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 sure, with the rest of us.
That's going to put a wrap on today's edition of the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. Keep up with all the things we're doing by visiting mattandjeff.net. And of course, you can also send us email at feedback@mattandjeff.net. Our thanks to Grantley Phillips, who was our guest today. Make sure you pick up his latest album, Walking in the Green Corn. And if he's coming to your neck of the woods, go see a show. Absolutely. GrantleyPhillips.com and GrantleyBuffalo.com are two great websites that you should check out to stay informed on the latest happenings. Our big thanks also to Jim and Rebecca from the Winchester right here in Cleveland for giving us a place to do today's edition of the Radio Hour, and especially for continuing to bring great artists like Grantley Phillips to Cleveland. They've got a great schedule of upcoming shows, and you can check all that out at thewinchester.net. Thanks for listening to the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour, and stay tuned. We'll be back with another episode very, very soon.